Hello, you lover of architecture, and today, interior design. Welcome to Prairie Design Lab, a podcast coming to you from the Faculty of Architecture at the University of Manitoba. Prairie Design Lab is a podcast that builds on all that has been accomplished by the faculty and the graduates of the first architecture faculty in Western Canada, founded a century ago. I'm Terry McLeod, the host, producer, and writer of Prairie Design Lab. I was joined recently by two graduates of interior design at U of M. Cindy Rodick owns the Winnipeg interior design firm called RIDI. Lois Wellwood is the global interiors practice leader of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, SOM. She grew up in Winnipeg and has worked in interior design in many cities. She currently lives in Los Angeles.
Cindy! Gee whiz!
Lois!
Hey!
How are you?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think we all used to say, oh, you know, I'm great. And it's now it's as good as can be imagined, given all of this, right? How the heck are you?
I'm good. I'm really...
You two know each other?
We went to university together.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. It's,
Before we begin, would each of you describe your practice for me? Cindy, would you start?
I have a design degree, but I also have a master's in facilities management consulting. So I do interior design commercially, primarily, as well as institutionally. And sometimes I work within a larger team. Sometimes I work independently. When I work in a larger team, sometimes that is as a support to architects. And sometimes we bring architects on and they support us. It's a small practice, but in Winnipeg, it's one of the larger interior design practices. So there's 10 of us. We tend to do, you know, quite complex kinds of projects, larger scale, multi-million dollar projects, which mostly sit in the commercial and institutional arena.
And Lois, how do you describe your practice with SOM?
Well, SOM is about 1,200 people. So scale-wise, Cindy and I are really different ends of the spectrum, which is really interesting, I think, in this conversation. So SOM has practiced interiors probably since its inception, and then in 1956 really formalized it. So we often say we are a multidisciplinary firm working in an interdisciplinary manner. So we have structural engineering, mechanical and electrical, architecture, of course, interiors, but also city planning and landscape architecture. And so to us, that means we can aggregate ourselves in any number of ways with a client forum. And we do work to scale from very small projects, very almost boutique in nature, to multi-million dollar, 10, 15, 20 year projects. Specifically for interior design, we work very often with our architectural colleagues, but we also do what we call standalone work, where we're working directly with a client, and it would be a tenant-driven design project where the architecture exists and we're inserting them into a floor, a couple of floors, a whole building sometimes. Not unlike Cindy, our practice is really focused on workplace. A corporate office often is the reference, but we also do residential, multifamily residential. We don't do any single family. We do hospitality work, so with hotels, restaurants. We do some healthcare. We do quite a bit of education, higher ed mostly, as opposed to K through 12. And we do airports.
Why did you choose interior design, Cindy?
I mean, both Lois and I are a few years into our career. At that time, I think it was really encouraged for women who had sort of a design sensibility and technical sensibility to be kind of pushed in that arena. That said, I think my natural inclinations are detail orientation. And I mean, I like macro scale, but I'm very comfortable on a micro scale. That's what I think you really have to have that sensibility and that attention to detail to really succeed in this profession.
Lois, why did you choose interior design?
Try not to stretch this out too long, but I was competed nationally in high school in track and field. I was either in the gym or I was in art classes. And so those were the sort of two areas I think I was really interested in. I knew that a professional athlete probably wasn't a future per se. And I thought being a starving artist wasn't really the route, but the creation of three-dimensional space was always something I was interested in the art that I did. My art teacher said, you know, you work really well in detail and spatial integration, spatial relationships. You're a three-dimensional thinker. Architecture may be of interest, but I think interior design is even more suited to you. One of the things I think about interior design, the way we practice it, is it's not necessarily understood. I often think of it as interior architecture, and it is truly shaping the experience. Is it in a three-dimensional space or spaces, 5,000 square feet to 2 million square feet? And so the work that we do is not applied. It's very much integral to shaping a building, shaping spaces. So to call it interior architecture, maybe small I, small a, because architecture is, you know, sort of a protected word in many ways in our industry. But we think about experiences in space and not just what's, say, applied to the wall or the furniture piece that's selected. It's all part of it, but it is much more than that.
Many people outside of your industry sometimes confuse interior design with interior decorating. What do you think of that?
That's a problem. It's a huge problem for our industry.
Yes.
And it's a historical issue. The challenge is interior design really only started in the 50s in many areas, and the University of Manitoba was a prime example where it became a department within the faculty. Interior design is, in some provinces, is a protected term. In Manitoba, it's not. What is protected, we have a Titles Act, it's called professional interior design, but anyone can call themselves an interior designer. That's not protected. As far as the architectural piece, architecture, being an architect is protected. That's a protected term. So we in Canada cannot use the term interior architecture. I know in the States it may be different, but in Canada you will be approached by the professional associations of architects in the various jurisdictions if you use that term. It's a big issue. It's an issue that, and I'm involved in our professional practice from our provincial body, it's an issue that we are constantly fighting. The misunderstanding of what we as professionals do. I mean, that's why I was very interested in this dialogue, because anything that can help move that needle would be very beneficial for the industry as a whole.
Every province is different. It depends on the legislation and how it came together. So much of my time in Canada was in Ontario as a professional practicing in Ontario under, again, a very similar body that is representing designers in Manitoba. And then in Alberta, I'm a licensed interior designer, but you cannot use the term architect in your business name on a business card unless you are a licensed architect. Even if you're not a licensed architect and you've graduated from an architectural school, you cannot use the term architect in your title until you've passed your exams. It's similar here in the States. The American Institute of Architects holds that word as their right to use it and others cannot. So it's a similar situation. We don't want to wade into interior designers are better than decorators, et cetera. They're just different. And I think there's a time and a place for decorating, if you will, and there have been some exemplary practitioners in that realm, but what we do is very different, and hence why we have associations in each of the provinces, and then a body that is called Interior Designers Canada that deals with the country as a whole, in the same way that each province has a provincial architectural association. It's quite complex, unfortunately, but the associations, one of their core missions is A, to protect the name, but the name has integrity starting with your education and then accredited body that has to go through a very rigorous set of tests every, I want to say 7 years, Cindy, I think you have to go back through the CEDA accreditation. And then that means also that you are keeping up with your continuing education requirements, you're registered with the association. We too write tests, a lot of them, around a standard of care, because we do stamp drawings, we can and do often create interconnecting stairs. We work with structural engineers. We change buildings. We introduce mechanical, electrical systems, lighting systems. And we have to know all about that. We have to know how to specify it. And we also are ultimately responsible for what is in the drawings that are issued for construction and getting that construction permit and getting the occupancy permits. So there's a fair amount of onus on us as professionals to have the knowledge, expertise, and follow through on those. Whereas someone designing the spaces within a home may change the light fixture, but they may not move any of the electricity. They may specify all the materials and finishes throughout that home, but they're not necessarily licensed or authorized to take walls down and change the structure where we would be.
I know both of you work a lot in workplace design. What are the forces that are affecting workplace design right now?
Let's talk about the fun stuff, yeah. Right, Cindy?
Yeah, let's talk about COVID. You know, there's been a lot of interesting sort of analysis and research that's been done over the course of the last year from how to reshape the workplace in order to provide sufficient distancing between people and not crossing paths. And I think there's been a shift in the last, I would say, 2 or 3 months to look at, you know, how are people actually functioning outside the office now? There was a real interest and uptake in people's acceptance of working outside the office and really liking it. Now, I think there's been a shift to individuals saying, you know what, maybe this isn't the panacea. This is something that, you know, it doesn't work well for young families. Now that individuals are living it and working in that environment, they're not necessarily enjoying it as much. That's one issue. I think the whole mechanical issue is going to change zone HVAC systems. There's been some really interesting things happening in China. I think they are going to start to move into the North American market. I think there's going to be some really interesting things happening around transitioning knowledge from sort of the healthcare environment into the workplace environment in regards to material selection and in regards to antimicrobial finishes and things like that.
Lois, how much thought do you give to interiors that will attract specific kinds of employees, giving them what they want or giving the employer something that will be a magnet to draw employees?
Workplace has tended over the last 5 years to veer towards a very much a one size fits all, reduce square footage per person. And the human element of it, frankly, was being overlooked in many ways for reduce real estate, manage costs. And I don't think people were having great experiences at work. Frankly, we talked about amenity spaces and these great centralized spaces of interconnecting stairs and the great kitchens and food offerings. But when you went back to your office and you were maybe not even an arm's length from the person beside you, that wasn't great. Acoustics were a huge challenge. And what was happening is, to offset that, everyone was putting earbuds in and listening to music. So now people aren't talking to each other. In my mind, the real benefit of being in an office is the sharing of ideas. We don't all collaborate 100% of the time, but tacit learning, hearing that conversation from a senior manager just a couple of rows down or across the way, and learning a lot more than you would just on your own. All those things are really important, but it seemed like we were doing everything, or being pushed towards doing everything, to squeeze the most amount of people into a space and creating not an ideal situation for them. What COVID has done for us is pushed us more quickly. Maybe it's a sea change, that might be an overstatement, to think about what workplace means. We do tend to want to go to a single solution. You know, working from home now, we trust everybody, you can do it. Maybe that's the answer. Or we'll bring everybody back to work, you know, because they miss each other. I don't think it's an either or. I think we've learned that we can make both work. So what is it about focused, heads down work that could be best at home and come to work for mentoring, collegiality, and engagement in ways that talking to each other across from the screen that we're all using will never replace? I think we have an amazing opportunity with organizations to really talk about culture and how culture exists within the workplaces that we create. And it's a place they want to be and they can thrive and they have choices. I'm going to work from home today. I'm going to let my team know if we need to connect. Zoom's still going to be around and I might be at home, but then I'm going to close Zoom and I'm going to get some thinking done. And then tomorrow I'm going to come to the office, and we've all agreed on that. So might be a bit more planning. We've already found that working from home takes an incredible amount of planning, because I can't turn around and say, you know, hey, Cindy, take a look at this. I got Cindy, are you available right now? Okay, let's get a Zoom call set up. Okay. It takes probably 15 minutes out of every hour to just get organized. So I'm optimistic that what has the potential is that we don't go back to normal, that we look at this as a moment to reconcile the things that weren't great about the office, optimize the things that were, and create experiences for employees that they can really thrive in ways that they feel like they're contributing. They have a modicum of control over their lives. And that means you might stop working at 4 and pick it up again at 8. And that's okay, because the work's going to get done. We're all global now, and it doesn't matter. We talk in many with tools we didn't have before. So I think it's an immense opportunity.
Lois did, you know, hit the nail on the head. I think that there's been so much pressure on real estate, and not so much in Manitoba, but from a North American perspective, there's been huge pressure to downsize real estate. And the trend was, well, we'll take space from the individual and we'll give it to the sort of communal use within the real estate. So we're not changing the overall real estate that we're renting or we're building, we're just going to apportion it differently. And so it was all being taken from the me space, pushed to the we space, and those individual spaces became somewhat intolerable. I mean, I've worked in Europe, that's worse than North America in regards to the amount of individual space that is attributed. I think this has forced us to reassess, and it'll be really interesting to see how organizations respond as we move out of COVID.
Can we talk a little bit about beauty and utility and wonder? I want you to brag a little bit. Tell me about your most beautiful, most appealing designs lately. Lois?
One of the things when we've talked about beauty of late is thinking about dignity and a broad range of people. And what is it about space that makes people feel welcome, invited, and engaged? And that is, I think, some of the tools we've found to be promising in that are elements of biophilia. And so that's bringing nature into spaces. That's thinking about natural light, access to views, interior lighting, you know, circadian lighting based on circadian rhythm starting to be thought about a lot more. So those are a few examples that they cross borders and they cross cultures. Most cultures all value nature and connection to it. That can be challenging. You know, I spent almost 5 years in New York, and when you're on the 45th floor of a tower in downtown Manhattan, nature isn't probably something that you see out your window. In fact, you're probably looking at the, you know, brick wall across back lane. So how we think about those interior environments and how we introduce elements of nature. I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, just a bunch of color is going to make people feel great. And it can, if you're Google, that works for Google, but I don't think it works for many others. So spaces that have clarity of circulation, grounding that plan in real clarity around circulation so you don't need signage everywhere, that people can see each other, that they feel like there's a culture that they can participate in. You know, a favorite project of late was for one of the big financial institutions in the U.S., and they had a tech center in Brooklyn that, you know, was an old check processing facility, which really was, had its time had played out. And they had a second floor cafeteria, and they said, we just need a new cafeteria. It's a little out of date. And we said, well, we don't actually think that's what you need. We think you need a place for people to come and connect in ways that they don't in their day-to-day work. So 65,000 square feet on that floor. So an immense opportunity. It was on the second floor, so you could see the parks adjacent to it. And so we stripped that space out and started to create a series of rooms that were interconnected, libraries, games rooms that, you know, had some pretty interesting full contact ping pong and things like that, as it turned out. And I say that jokingly. They had teams and games from scratch kitchen. You could create your own meals, retail part to it, a coffee shop that it was okay to go there any time of the day and have coffee and meet. While it may not sound like it's, you know, cutting edge, bleeding edge, for them as a financial institution that has real institutional requirements and regulatory requirements, this was a big step forward to them in terms of how to bring a sense of place that wasn't there before. And then the fun, and I think the beauty in what we did, is we said, let's make it authentic to the place. And Brooklyn has amazing parades, different events. So we, the graphics in it brought the most celebrated parades and celebrations in Brooklyn. And they're bright and they're lively and they have farmers markets. So we used images of beautiful food because we think food is beautiful. And it created a sense of place that was just like no other. And it's sort of been held up as an example in this organization for what they want to do.
And Cindy, for you, tell me about one of your favorite recent designs.
I guess the most recent is a law firm that we did, a firm by the name of Taylor McCaffrey in Winnipeg. They had been in their space for 35 years, and they really wanted to take this opportunity to transform themselves in a way. And one of the things we do at the beginning of any project is we really look at sort of what the strategic objectives are of a company, look at their goals and objectives as a business. And, you know, attraction and retention of staff is a huge one, and in the law industry as well. So we looked at, as Lois said, what's working, what isn't working. You know, what are things that we want to hold on to and take with us in this new environment? And we spent a fair amount of time, you know, looking at precedents. We toured. We went outside the city and we toured other law firms. We, you know, looked at what was on the bleeding edge and where their comfort level as an organization, what their culture was, and making sure that we were translating who they were and we were translating that into the physical space. So connecting their brand, and they had just gone through a rebranding exercise. So, you know, ensuring that that the brand was consistent both from the printed material through to the physical space. So there's no disconnect, both for a client or for an employee, that message was inherent from the moment you walked into the space, through the space into the workspace. Issues of, you know, respect of the client-centered space. They had something that was sort of sacrosanct to their organization. It was called the Blackstone Lounge. And it was where new lawyers were invited up, or any major partner celebration. It was, to them, it was one of the things they were known for within their market. So we brought that front and center, and we actually opened that up to the reception area. So when you entered, you had, it was a very inviting, very, that's where the money was spent, a very, very significant space. Which was also linked to their conference suite. All of that is to say that we really tried to respect their brand, transform the organization, and put them sort of at the forefront of the industry within the local market.
Can we talk about that a little bit more? And not to be the provocateur here, but maybe just a little bit. Because I think we've also been talking to clients, ironically, about their client spaces. And so we do law firms. Cindy, it'd be great to kind of talk about the future of law, maybe on another call, because they're going through some real evaluations of how does law remain vital, and pressure on fees, attraction and retention. Everybody's a tech firm now. And, you know, the Googles and Apples of the world pay exemplary salaries. So it'd be really interesting to talk about that. One of the things we have tried to find a balance with clients is that while the client-centric spaces are really important, the people that are there the most are your employees. And we've all seen those projects where the reception is extraordinary and the meeting rooms are beautiful. And then you open this other door and it's like, is this the same organization, right? And so what is it that can blur a line at that transition point where it doesn't feel like it wasn't given the same care and consideration? And we understand we're spending clients' money. It's theirs. It is our responsibility to think about it, be careful with it, and respect their wishes, if you will, but in some ways help them think about all of the other elements that make a successful organization. And I don't know about you, but of late, we're certainly finding people that come to interview with us, they're interviewing us as much as we are interviewing them. And I have to think, you know, all our clients are going through that too. So what is my environment going to be? What is your diversity program? What is your plan for flex hours? You know, where I work, I want to be comfortable. I want to feel like I'm respected and I'm valued. So how does that translate into the physical space?
Yeah, I mean, I find that our clients are as interested in their clients as they are as interested in their staff. And I mean, Taylor McCaffrey, as an example, you know, the Blackstone Lounge, which was hidden in the past, is front and center, but it's not just for clients. It's for everyone, because it's an environment for everyone within the organization, and it's used. It's almost inviting the client in to the organization, because it acts as this bridge space between the reception area and the workspace. And we did a very similar kind of piece for Cargill Grain's headquarters, Canadian headquarters, bringing that staff element like more front and center, adjacent to the reception area, space that can be used for receptions, space that can be opened up, but not being afraid to bring who they are forward to the face of the client. And I think it makes those organizations a little bit more human and more approachable. And it actually honors their staff. And their staff, I think, there's an appreciation there.
Cindy Rodick owns the Winnipeg interior design firm called RIDI. Lois Wellwood is the global interiors practice leader of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, SOM. She grew up in Winnipeg. She joined us from Los Angeles.
For a deeper exploration with Rodick and Wellwood, tune in to our longer podcast version of this conversation. Thanks to Professor Jason Chan of University of Manitoba and to Finn McLeod of SOM Chicago. You can find us on most podcast apps, and you can follow us on Twitter at Prairie D Lab. I'm Terry McLeod, the host, producer, and writer of Prairie Design Lab.